Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded January 8th, 2025, and welcome to the first show of this new year, where despite Monday's news of a change of leadership in this Canada, we unhappily pick up foreign policy where last left off, with all Canadian institutional pillars four square in support of Israel and its Holocaust initiated October 8th, 2023. But how can it be, you may wonder, the renowned paragon of virtue, rule of law, universal human rights, etc., remains not just mute, as the crime of the century unfolds, but actually assists and profits its prosecution. Peter Eglin is author, co-author, or co-editor of seven books and numerous book chapters, journal articles, and sundry pieces published in magazines and the press. And while his book, The Montreal Massacre, co-written with Stephen Hester, was shortlisted for the Innes Prize for Best English Language Book in the Social Sciences, the now-retired Wilfrid Laurier University Professor of Sociology has not rested on his laurels. His latest book, Analyzing the Israel Effect in Canada, A Critical Autoethnography, is freshly out, published by Routledge Press. Peter Eglin in the first half. And Palestine is not the limit of Israel's atrociousness. Lebanon, too, is under its bombardment, despite or because of the ceasefire deal entered into by Hezbollah and the Lebanese government, such as it is. Monday, the former Israeli soldier currently acting as U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Amos Hochstein, visited Beirut, bringing threats of more bombing by Israel if Hezbollah didn't surrender the south of the country, or words to that effect. Dan Kovalix, a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's just returned from Lebanon, talking to the people there and bringing their stories home to his fellow Americans. Dan's book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, the Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests, and his latest, The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. Dan Kovalik and ungodly goings-on in the Holy Land in the second half. But first, Peter Eglin and a Canadian atrocity tale. Well, welcome to the program, Peter.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, Peter, you were in Hamilton last month launching your book at Jordan's Homeside Pub, which looks like a terrific place to be. How has your book, Analyzing the Israel Effects in Canada, been received by Canadians so far, Peter?
Well, overall, it's hard to tell because big publishers these days don't do much in the way of marketing. You have to do it yourself. And although I had a wonderful reception at Jordan's Homeside Pub, thanks to Kent Stone, people were very attentive and applauded me at the end and bought a lot of books. And I had an equally good reception at a friend's house in Guelph, which he opened up and invited a lot of people. And we had a really good session there, and they've sold another pile of books. Still, what the sort of national picture is, or the global picture is, I have no idea. I did write to my editor and the American sales office to ask about sales, but they haven't got back to me, so I can't tell you what that's like. So far, I've had nothing negative said about it. But that's because the people who have shown up at these events are generally on side with the Palestinian situation. I mean, I've had, I've had accusations of anti-Semitism thrown at me before, but not yet on this one.
Yeah, well, you'd expect, especially at the friend's house, you're preaching, so to speak, to the converted. What about that? What about the flak? Now, I saw you on Eve Engler's Foreign Policy Hour. You guys recorded, I just saw it the other day, but you guys recorded it in August when the book was early out. And you talk a lot about the kind of flak that you receive for taking your positions as a proponent of the Palestinian cause, among others that you've been interested in. Peter, can you tell me, you've been at this a long time, a very long time, a very, very long time, not to put too sharp a point on it. I've been doing this, what I'm doing here, for a long time, and it's really a pleasure for me to talk to somebody that whose provenance in this kind of activism precedes my own. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you came from your sinecure at the university to stick your neck out into these kinds of issues. Palestine is a particular one, but others too.
Yeah, I was hired at Wilfrid Laurier University in 1976, and got tenure in 1980. And as you say, that it is a privileged position and gives you a lot of protection for if you speak out about things. It's a pity that more faculty don't make use of it in that regard. But for those first almost 15 years, I kept my head down because I was busy trying to be a good professor of sociology and doing service to the university and so on. But then in 1988, my personal life came unstuck in a way. I got divorced. My children were across the ocean. And I heard Chomsky's Massey lectures on CBC Radio in the fall of 1988, that was subsequently published as Necessary Illusions, Thought Control in Democratic Societies. And it kind of blew me away. I'd read Chomsky and both his linguistics and his politics when I was a graduate student, but then I'd had to drop the politics because, as I say, I was busy being a good sociologist. But this all came back to me, and in my kind of maybe fragile emotional state, I decided, oh, goodness, I've got to do something. And I became, from that point on, a kind of activist, and both academic and outside. So I started a human rights course at the university in January 1990. It ran for the first time. And we looked at, following Chomsky, I looked at what my government and my society was doing in as opposed to, blaming enemies, having the focus there. And so I looked at Canadian complicity or involvement in international or state terrorism initially in the topics that Chomsky himself has sort of put into my head. So East Timor, I became a big activist on East Timor, El Salvador, Central America generally, and the Middle East, particularly the situation of the Palestinians, about which I knew very little at that time. And so I kind of educated myself about it and got into it first in, I guess I wrote a letter to the Globe and Mail for the first time in 1990 in response to an article that was saying that Canada should cut its ties with the PLO, I think it was. And I sort of pointed out who was most responsible for trouble in the world and conflict and violence. And I pointed the finger at the United States and said, who should we cut ties with? And I left it like that. Of course, it wasn't printed. I've never had anything printed in the Globe and Mail, despite, over 30 years. They never, not a single letter. I was interested in how the Globe covered the First Intifada, which started late 1987 and went through till 1993, because they were writing about it every day. I was a subscriber to the Globe in those days. And, as the major newspaper in Canada, I thought it was important to see what they said. And I gathered all the coverage I could from around 1989 through 1992, not the whole 6 years, but a big slab of it. And what struck me was the way that photographs were used to accompany news articles. And when I gathered all of them and looked at them systematically, it became clear that there was this pro-Israeli bias. So that in the Intifada, the uprising that Palestinians made in those years, their loss of life was many times higher than Israeli Jews. But the pictures that accompanied stories were overwhelmingly pictures of weeping Israeli Jews who maybe had lost a parent or a child or a co-worker or an associate, and no pictures of grieving Palestinians whose losses were far more substantial. And that kind of discrepancy struck me. I presented a paper about it at the Learned Societies, as they were then called, in 1992 in Prince Edward Island, and wrote it up. And I sent it to, I got a request for the paper from Thelma McCormack, who was a noted sociologist in Canada and a feminist and defender of gay rights, a sort of a rights activist in her own regard, and as expert on communications, for a book that she was editing. And the book came out, so I sent her the paper in 1992. In 1995, the book came out, my paper wasn't in it. And I got back from her She sent it back to me and said, oh, I found this under a pile of papers on my desk. I thought you'd like to have it back. So, you know, that was the sort of beginning of she was, her maiden name is Herman. She was American. She was Jewish American. And I think that that's something to do with the fact that there's not a word about Palestine in the book itself, this collection of essays about war and peace and to do with the United States, the Palestinian initiative didn't arise. And of course, my paper wasn't included.
In those days, the days you talk about, the early 90s, it seems today, especially in regard to what's going on in Gaza as we speak, be the halcyon days for the Palestinians, at least. What we're seeing now is so much worse. But in 2009, and you were speaking again in that August interview with Eve Engler about Cass Lead, when the Israelis started to name their atrocities, Operation Cass Lead of 2000, over Christmas of 2008, I remember well, you said that it pushed you to, as you said, to try to excite a response from the university as an intellectual institution to the attack on a school in Palestine, as one university to another, something that now we've seen taken off the scale. Do you want to explain a little bit, Peter, about what happened then and how you took it to the square at Laurier?
Yeah, I was on a sabbatical leave for the winter term of 2009. As you say, Operation Cast Lead began on December 28th of 2008. So I wasn't on campus, but I heard about the bombing of a United Nations school where some 40 or 45 Palestinians were residing because their refugee camp had been bombed, and they were killed in a raid. And And then I was kind of so distressed about this. I went onto campus on early 4th or 5th of January, grabbed a mic and a speaker and set up in the concourse, which is a kind of open area in the center of the university where, you know, events happened. And I just started speaking that afternoon to anybody who might listen. And I'd also learned at that point also that the university, the Islamic University of Gaza, had been attacked and partially some of the buildings had been destroyed. And so I thought that it was incumbent on an educational institution like a university that's dedicated to truthful speaking. You know, the motto of my university was Veritas, Veritas Omnia Vincit, which means truth conquers all. And, you know, I thought, I thought it's kind of important. And so I did that and then went back the following day. And there was immediately an attempt by the Jewish Students Association. They went to the administration and tried to get me stopped. And we got into some kind of conflict over that. And on the fourth rally, as it has been called, I went back again a third time, and then on the fourth time, it had become kind of significant event in the city and indeed in the country. B'nai B'rith showed up, and the university had the hate crimes unit of the Waterloo Regional Police present. And I got I got called by a radio station in Israel. And the Canadian Jewish News covered it, so it became a kind of a big event. But I was simply motivated by the, as you say, the fact that as academics, as intellectuals who have a responsibility for truthful speaking, especially in relation to the assault on educational institutions and schools and universities, that we shouldn't stand by and simply ignore it. I mean, you know, the responsibility of onlookers was kind of, if the Holocaust taught us anything in 1942, 45, it's that you just can't stand by while people are wiped out. It's unconscionable. And that responsibility falls particularly on those who have the capacity and the resources, as Chomsky says, to do something about it, to speak out and, you know, get people to see that there's awful things that are happening that shouldn't be allowed to go on. Try to do whatever you can to stop them.
I wish that it was even that much in this country that we would stand up. But the fact that we're not saying anything officially is one thing. But the fact that this country, Canada, profits by what's happening right now to the Palestinians is another altogether. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Peter Eglin. Peter's an author, co-author, co-editor of 7 books and numerous books, or book chapters rather, journals, articles, sundry pieces published in magazines and the press. While his book, The Montreal Massacre, written with Stephen Hester, was shortlisted for the Innes Prize for Best English Language Book, Peter hasn't rested on his laurels. His latest book is Analyzing the Israel Effect in Canada, a critical autoethnography. That's easy for you to say. And it's out on Routledge Press. So today, Peter, on the campus, things have gotten, you've retired from Wilfrid Laurier, but things have gotten much more severe. The pushback that students and faculty receive in opposing what's happening to Palestine is by magnitude greater. This past summer, there was a glimmer of hope where students across the country and across the world followed the American example and set up tents and camps and everything in the quads of the universities across the country and received not support in most cases, almost universally, but opposition from university and the legal professions as well. What did you make of the past summer's activities on campuses?
I thought the students and the small numbers of faculty who supported them, I thought they were tremendous. I visited the encampment here at the University of Waterloo until they were threatened with a lawsuit by the administration. The actions of the administrations have been disgraceful. They're just a disgrace to the mission and point of universities in response to this awful genocidal assault in Gaza. Likewise, the major newspapers and the flipping CBC. It's intolerable what has been going on. But I'm very proud of what the students have attempted. Montreal was particularly good. The University of Toronto did their best. What needs attention is the arguments. They don't even provide arguments that are of any substance. But the sheer mendacity of university administrations and equivalent professional institutions, Canadian Medical Association. I've recently written a paper which I'm trying to get published around the responsibility of professional associations in general. Like, one of the things that Israel has done in the West Bank and in Gaza is just tear up the city infrastructure, the infrastructures of cities, the roads, the sewers, the water systems, the buildings, just destroying buildings, so as to make, not only kill people, but to make the possibility of socially organized life virtually impossible, what I call sociocide. The idea that you're a professional planner in a city, or you're in a professional association of people who deal with sewers or water mains, surely you should say something about what's going on in the destruction of a city like Gaza City, Khan Yunis, or whatever it is, and just not sort of just look on. That I find just intolerable.
You subtitled your book, at least your talk, as a Canadian atrocity tale. The Kamal Adwan Hospital now is rubble. Its director, Dr. Abu Safia, disappeared in one of these black hole torture, so-called prisons that the Israelis operate. I see his mother died today of grief, or officially a heart attack. I see today that Michael Gove, the former minister of David Cameron, he who has amorous feelings for porcine members of our community, saying that the IDF should be nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize more than opposing these things. This is the kind of response we get. It's kind of crazy making, I find.
When the current assault started on October 7th, my wife and I would watch Al Jazeera English TV news at 10 o'clock each night. We'd go to bed and that would be what we'd watch, 10 to 10:30. What? By about, I don't know when it was, after about 3, 4, 5 months, I could not bear to watch it anymore. My own psyche just couldn't stand watching, because the whole half hour of news broadcast or a substantial portion of it would be taken up with what was going on in Gaza. And it was just unbearable. I found in the end I could not. Margaret Atwood has a great poem, that the last line of which is, "Witness is what you must bear." And it has a double meaning. I think you could hear it. I could not bear to be my own personality. You just couldn't withstand being continuing to bear the witness to these awful atrocities that were happening. It was just too much for me personally. I can write about it, but I could not bear to see it.
Well, this is it. I've been going
Second, I did listen to your radio, your program, I think not yesterday morning, the morning before, interviewed a Palestinian doctor, I think, who talked at length about...
Tarek Loubani,
he's a great guy. And that was, I just have to commend you, that was a remarkable account that he gave, and you gave him all that time to speak, and in the end, unbearable for him, too.
Well... Peter, and I've said, I put that up as a part of my year ender, although it was December 20th of 2023 that I spoke with him. But I've been doing the show, as I mentioned, a long time, 25 years. That was, I think, the most poignant interview I've ever taken part in. Was with Tarek. Not the first time I've talked to him, and not the only Palestinian doctor I've talked to either. And this is a case where, as you mentioned, that the professions have been absent, although there is a swelling movement now of the medical professions in Canada and the United States and around the world, watching especially that poignant photograph of Dr. Abu Safia, who, like a captain being the last off a sinking ship, walked through the rubble of what was his hospital, the Kamal Adwan Hospital in North Gaza, towards the waiting tanks, and to be disappeared into these black holes that these people have created. Poignant and terrible times for sure. Peter, we're out of time. We're fast out of time right now. How do people get their hands on your book? And Peter's book is Analyzing the Israel Affecting Canada, a Critical Autoethnography.
Yeah, Routledge is an academic publisher, and I was rejected 38 times before they took it, and so they had to give it a kind of academic cast, even though I didn't write it as an academic book, but it has an academic price, I'm afraid. It's available on their website, Routledge's website, for $44 American, which is a horrible price in Canadian dollars.
Yeah, I buy a house for that.
Yeah, I know. It's terrible. I wanted it to be a trade book, which, you know, it comes in around $25-$30, but it's an academic book. They sell it to universities. That's the pricing. You can get it from their website. That's the way to do it. You can write to me and I can send you a copy. It'll cost you.
Oh, you disappeared on me, Peter. Ooh, that one sounds serious. Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're having a little bit of technical glitches here, Peter. But all right. Well, again, Analyzing the Israel Effect in Canada, the author, Peter Eglund. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking to us about your book and your experiences today, Peter.
I'm very obliged. Thank you so much, Chris, for letting me have a platform. Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome here anytime. I want everyone else to stick around. I'm going to take a break, and I'm going to play some, as I've done often, David Rovics to cover the transition. But I'll be back with Dan Kovalik. He's just back from Lebanon, the author himself of The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. Thanks again, Peter.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favourite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, however, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
In a tent they died, displaced and starved with no blankets inside. In Almawasi, where every tent contains the last moments some parents spent with their kids as they stiffened before they became victims of this war. 50 people killed, mostly women and kids. And then the next thing the IDF did, 2 days after Christmas, they set fire to the buildings. And as the flames rose higher, they ordered all the patients out on the street if they weren't already buried down beneath. In the siege of Kamal Adwan Hospital, their terrorist cell, but as they already knew well, the place was just full of the maimed, dead and ill, and doctors and nurses doing God's will, taking care of them while knowing each day could be the last one they're able to stay. Day arrives at the first moment of the year 25. It's been several days there in Jabalia since anyone saw Dr. Abu Safia or so many others who stayed by the side of their patients who otherwise would have died. Fireworks or watch the ball in Times Square as it falls. While far away, the deadly siege turns into famine and disease. In the siege of Kamal Adwan Hospital. In the siege of Kamal Adwan Hospital. They die.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, Palestine is not the limit of Israel's atrociousness. Lebanon, too, is under its bombardment despite or because of the ceasefire deal entered into by Hezbollah and the Lebanese government, such as it is. Monday, the former Israeli soldier currently acting as U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, Amos Hochstein, visited Beirut, bringing threats of more bombing by Israel if Hezbollah didn't surrender the south of the country, or words to that effect. Lebanon's presidential election is tomorrow, January 9th, and Hochstein told his hosts Israel's impatience with Hezbollah's evacuation was growing and reminded acquiescence would still not guarantee a peace, saying, quote, these commitments do not preclude either Israel or Lebanon from exercising their inherent right of self-defense consistent with international law, of course. Danko Valix, a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author and filmmaker. He's just returned from Lebanon, talking to the people there and bringing their stories home to his fellow Americans. Dan's book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, The Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. His latest is The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. Welcome back to the program, Dan.
Hey, it's always good to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Well, and welcome home. I mean, as usual, as I said, you're traveling still, just back from Lebanon. Lebanon's fallen off the media radar somewhat since the fall of Syria. What did you find, Dan, going there and talking to the people?
Well, first of all, I have to emphasize what an amazing country Lebanon is. It's multicultural, multi-religious. It's a beautiful place, so I need to underscore that. You know, but meanwhile, say if I was in Beirut, that's where I was stationed.